Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, Coach. I'm excited to announce a brand new way to access our resources to elevate your coaching monthly memberships. At Basketball Immersion, we know every coach's journey is unique, just like your players' skill sets. That's why we're dedicated to providing you with the flexibility you crave. Our new monthly access plan lets you get full access to all our videos and courses on a month-to-month basis, giving you the freedom to cancel or renew as needed. Whether you're just starting out or looking to add some fresh perspectives to your existing coaching repertoire, Basketball Immersion has the resources to help you reach your goals. Head over to basketballimmersion.com to take control of your coaching journey and unlock your full potential with Basketball Immersion.
Excited to welcome Fairfield head coach Carly Thibault-Dedonis to the Basketball Podcast. In just her second season at the helm, Carly led the Stags to his program record 31 wins as part of a historic 31-2 campaign, the second highest winning percentage in the nation. That mark featured a conference record 29-game winning streak, culminating in an MAAC championship, their fifth in program history. Thibault-Dedonis was named the Maggie Dixon Coach of the Year, All-Met Coach of the Year, the ECAC Coach of the Year, the College Insider Kay Yao Coach of the Year, and the MAAC Coach of the Year to celebrate Fairfield's historic season. The Stags also achieved the program's first ever national ranking as they slotted number 25 in the AP Top 25 poll and also received votes in the USA Today Coaches poll. They finished the season ranked fourth in the College Insider Mid-Major poll. The Stags capped off their historic season with an MAAC tournament and regular season championship while punching their ticket to the 2024 NCAA tournament. Carly was recently the associate head coach and recruiting coordinator at the University of Minnesota. Before joining Minnesota, Carly was an assistant coach at Mississippi State and Eastern Michigan. Carly comes from a basketball family as her dad and brother both have coached extensively in the WNBA and college. Carly, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Awesome to have you. And what a year. What a great job you've done at Fairfield, and just tremendous, obviously, in terms of the profile and everything else that you brought to that program, and the first top 25 ranking in history. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been a really fun year. We have such wonderful women in our program. It's one thing to win, and it's another thing to do it with really good people and people who are selfless and invested in one another. So it's been a blast.
One of the things that stood out, I've watched some of your games on Synergy, and certainly you've seen some of the clips of different things. One of the things that stands out from the outside looking in is that your players seem to show passion for the game. They seem to really enjoy the experience. Talk to us a little bit about how you've crafted an environment where they seem to be able to outwardly display their enjoyment.
Yes, I feel really fortunate that I walked into a program that we didn't have to start over. We had some really good women in the program. Coach Frager recruited great people and had retired. And people like Janelle Brown and Lauren Beach, who are two of the returners from that group, were two of our captains this year. And you got Isabella Nicoletti Leite was another one of those captains. And those guys are all just incredibly passionate people. And I think when you're in an environment where you're around people who care about you, their teammates are pour into them and invest in them, that it's easy to just be yourself and be authentic in what that looks like. I think for me, and then we've added people to the program where I tell my staff all the time, like there's a lot of things from a basketball perspective that we look for, but to recruit people that love the game. I would not be your best coach and your best option if you don't love it. I want people who want to be in the gym, who want to keep getting better, who are hungry. And my staff's done a great job of recruiting more and more student athletes like that to just make it an environment that's fun to come to because everybody loves it.
That's great to hear. And a little bit different than sometimes we talk about coaches that come in, and obviously you took the program to the next level, but the program was pretty good. So talk to us. Normally, we can think about, okay, we can think of the positives of that. But what are some of the challenges in taking over a little bit of an established program with players who have played for a former coach and have had some success?
Yeah, so that team under Coach Frager that won the championship in 2022 had Lou Lopez-Senichal, who ended up finishing her career at UConn. Rachel Hakes was their point guard, and she graduated and finished her career at Tulane. And so a couple that graduated, Sam Lewis and Sydney Lowry, that didn't have any more eligibility. And so, you know, we had different pieces in a different team, and Coach Frager was incredibly smart in how he went about it. They played zone. It protected people like Lou from getting in foul trouble. They slowed it down to make sure that they ran their offense through her. And we knew we needed to play a little bit different style. I know I wanted to long term, in addition to the returning players, we tried to fit that group as best we could. Janelle Brown, who's been our player of the year this year and our point guard, we knew she needed to play in a little bit more open floor, speed the game up a little bit. And she was a great one on ball defender. So how can we find that happy medium of what this team was built to do in addition to find our next step and our next way that we wanted to play? And the challenge is just creating buy-in in a very different system and doing things in a very different way. But I'm really fortunate. Again, I go back to having really great people in the program that I didn't have to struggle too hard and too much. We didn't have too many growing pains in that buy-in, which made the, I think, the transition and this jump that we've made in year two so much easier.
Yeah, it's fun to hear that. And you talked about some of those changes. And one of those starts with obviously your team standards and establishing them for your players. Is that one of the first things you shared with them in terms of coming into the program last year?
Yes. And so my staff, once I got my staff hired, that was priority number one for me, is great people around me, people who are going to challenge me as a coaching staff. And so that was number one. My staff and I sat down and talked about that, our first chance that we got. And I had ideas of what I wanted to look at that to look like, what my standards were that fit with my values. I, as a person, my values are joy, truth, and relationships. And so how does that now translate into a team culture? And what do those standards look like? So our standards as a team are selfless, tough, accountable, and grateful. And that spells out the acronym STAG, our mascot. But all that being said, we didn't have this big, thick rule book of you're here at this time and all these different rules and stipulations. We have standards, and that allows us as coaches the flexibility to coach within our standards and hold accountable within our standards. Because not only does that make you a great basketball player, but that also, we hope, that prepares you and helps you be successful in life. So our staff got through that. And then once we got our team together in that first summer, we really dug into that and gave that to our team, make sure they understood what that looked like and coached from there. So I think in year one, we were able to really establish that culture based on that. And in year two, we just continued to add people who knew those are the expectations and bought into that as well.
Love it. And you could see that on the court and I imagine in practice as well. But you mentioned the basketball identity a little bit in terms of trying to open it up. And Coach Frager was one of my favorite follows in a way because he ran so many amazing sets, really good stuff. And you would have to change their identity in terms of basketball as well. So talk to us about maybe the offensive identity first, about how you established that and got them to be able to play such good basketball this season.
Yes. So if you look back to last year, we had to find a happy medium. We started in the summer. Okay, we're going to shoot a bunch of threes the way I want to play. And we got through partway the summer. I'm like, okay, we're not making a bunch of threes. We're not making as many shots as we think we can. So we found a happy medium of what fit that team, where we still found some post touches through some really good returning post players in Callie Kavanaugh and Andrea Hernan Gomez. But we still taught these concepts from an offensive standpoint of like the Spurs. I think they call it like the half second rule. We call it the 1 second rule. On a closeout or inside outside, you've got a second to decide, am I shooting it? Am I quick one moreing it? Or am I attacking a closeout? And so those kind of concepts we taught last year, but this year we were really able to take it the next step and open it up and really get to a full five out versus more of a four out, one in. And so we changed kind of our spacing from like slots and corners and one in to more of like top wings and corners. We still have opportunities for rim runs and post ups within that spacing, but we really could, we could space it out more because we don't call them post players. We call them road runners. They can now shoot threes and they can step out and they can go off the bounce and they can pass. So that allowed us to kind of take one more step now and really double down on that 1 second rule and that floor spacing and that ability to score efficiently. So we talk about sprint. I mentioned those five spots on the corner, on the floor, corners, wings, and top. And we sprint, we space, we score efficiently. We show a lot of different ways and teach that in a lot of different ways. And then we sacrifice. We played 9 to 10 this year. And so it's going to be somebody's different stepped up every night. And from the cool thing about year one is we didn't exactly have the exact same system, but we were able to teach them those concepts as far as pace. And the funny thing is after Coach Frager, they would look back at me a lot and be like, what's the play call? And I'm like, go, go. And now this year they've got that concept down. And then this team actually really struggled when I play called too much because they're a little bit better at more read and react now. We've taught a lot of the cutting, moving without the basketball, and they're actually better when there's not a predicted read or a predicted something you're trying to get out of a play.
Lots to dive into there. First of all, roadrunner and guard. You only list players as roadrunner and guard. So talk to us about those two things and then a little bit of the philosophy of naming them that on the roster.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we knew we wanted to get to that spacing on the floor. We'd studied and I'd played against even at Minnesota and places like that, like these mid-majors that have won games in March and won games in the NCAA tournament. And so you look at Creighton, Florida Gulf Coast, South Dakota on the women's side. And all those teams have versatile, quote unquote, posts. They space the floor in some version of a five out. So we studied a lot of that and we knew we wanted to recruit posts that could be on the perimeter that can space out. And that's sometimes how you can, again, go and win a game in the NCAA tournament in multiple, because that's a tough mismatch for some of the power five post players that are a little bit more back to the basket oriented. And so we had some success in the first half against Indiana in the same reason, and we were able to pick and pop and make people pick their poison. So we, in that same vein, I challenged Blake on my staff, who's also my husband, who coaches the posts, to create a different identity for that group that they can buy into, that's exciting, that fits them, where I'd rather take smaller and skilled than bigger with less skill. So we talked about gazelles, or is there something, is it whatever it would, what that name would be. And he came up with Roadrunners. And then of course, after that, we also had to explain to 18 to 22 year olds what the Roadrunner was. And so now we've abbreviated it because I struggled with the Roadrunners rim running. So they're now Meeps or Meep. So it's the guard Meeps.
So fun. So fun. And at first, maybe you had to explain to your players, but did you have to explain it to parents too? Sometimes I know you're a little divergent in your thinking, just like me. And sometimes these non-traditional things, which make sense to you, don't make sense to others.
We explain it to parents for sure. But I think it's actually almost an advantage in recruiting, because nowadays you're talking to families, you're talking to recruits. Very rarely do post players really want to be post players anymore. And so I think it's actually been an advantage, because we really talk about the want and need for that position in particular, but all our positions, to be versatile. We're not putting you on a box on the block, but there's a lot of opportunities to post up as well within our motion, within our cuts. So not putting you in a box. And I think that's been really fruitful in recruiting as well.
I love it. I've always told young players, when I ask them what position they are, so they'll obviously tell me a position, but I said, from now on, when somebody asks you, just say you're a basketball player. And if I ever coach again, I'm going to list them all as basketball player. Because that's what they all are nowadays.
Florida Gulf Coast, the same thing. All of them, theirs are listed as shooter along their roster. And that's, at the end of the day, I really don't care about positions. Like, we're going to play the best five at that time and whatever we need. And that's the beauty of our defensive. It was designed to that as well, that we switch everything, that it takes out the, am I the four? Am I the five? Who am I switching with? Who am I staying with? And it just simplifies so we can play whatever five we need at that moment.
Love it. And you mentioned like studying some of these mid-majors that have had success. And Carl Semesco at Florida Gulf Coast is obviously one of the best at that level to be able to study. Maybe what are some others that you would suggest to coaches to study to see how they have been able to adapt and play at that mid-major level against some of the power fives?
Absolutely. I know a ton of Florida Gulf Coast, Drake, Creighton, both South Dakota and South Dakota State have been really good examples. So we studied all of those pretty intensely.
Yeah, it's fun. And the five out, you talked about the spacing. Love it. One of the challenges in five out, of course, is creating gaps in space for advantages. So talk to us about some of your preferred ways to be able to create those advantages.
So in transition, we always talk about our road runners. If you are ahead of the ball, if you have one ahead of the ball, you get out and you run to the rim and see if we can't put some pressure on the defense. Either you might not always get the layup, but we got a ton of suck in and you got kick out threes or drive and kick threes in transition. We've got, if you're not ahead of the ball, then you're sprinting corners and you're sprinting wings. And that's the beauty of the versatility. We don't say our twos run this wing, our threes run this wing, fill those spots as quickly as possible. And so then when you get into the half court, we are in that top wings and corners. We try to keep our point guards in the middle of the floor to have the opportunity to, we call it Gus, go until stopped. And so then if they do get stopped early, then your offense looks like you're hitting a wing. And depending on who you're throwing it to and what their skill set is, doesn't really matter, guard or roadrunner. If you're hitting it to somebody that can go off the bounce and go off ball screens, then you can swing and ball screen, you can swing and ghost screen. If you're throwing it to someone that's maybe not as strong of a ball handler, you go and screen away. You can basket cut, but you go and screen away. And so now we get some of our reads in those screen away actions based on how defense guards us. If they're switching, if they're trying to get through, if we've got some different reads based on how people guard us. So then to your point, we're just trying to create some version of confusion and an advantage. So if you have, you know, one cut into the rim on that screen away and one popping, are they both going with one? Do you get an easy layup? Do you get an easy three? If not, are you creating a long closeout and getting that defense rotating?
This is why I love the podcast. I've always talked about go until you're stopped. And now you put words to it. Gus, love it. Yeah. Go until stopped. There we go.
We use it in ball screens as well. That's this concept that we not only use in transition, but attacking closeouts, attacking the rim. You go until stopped. And if you're stopped, jump stop, kick out. And we have heavily emphasized the jump stop.
Yeah, it gives you a great visual because we say drive to score, obviously, off of everything. So it means drive to score. Literally, you're going to score. And then obviously until you're stopped and then you draw two and you kick. So that's beautiful phrasing. The five out, you talked about playing a little bit conceptual, obviously, in that. What are some of the triggers that maybe trigger different actions to be able to go? You mentioned cutting off the ball. Let's start with that. What is something that triggers them to cut off the ball?
Yep. So if the ball gets swung away from you, there's an immediate, like I said, screen away. And some of your cuts are dependent on that. So if you have, let's say you're on the opposite wing and the top guard is coming to screen for you, depending on if your defender is trying to jam you up, you can, we have different names for it. You can back cut, refuse, and get that angle. Our guards can even change their angle on that screen to almost a back screen if they do that, if they try to jam you up. If they go underneath it, you can pop the guards or whoever the top person is in that can down screen instead of changing their angle for a back screen if they try to go underneath. At the trail, you've got a curl action and it reads on based on how your defender is guarding you. And then that's where we get a lot of our post entries is that high low, because again, you're putting tough decisions on the defense of where you're going to help from when you got shooters in the corner and in the wing. If you're going high low, a lot of our post feeds are from there. If they switch it, then great. That means we should have some advantages or disadvantages for the defense. There's also cutting opportunities in if you're denied on the wing, you can back cut there. Once the ball gets reversed from top to or from wing to top, there's a lot of cutting opportunities. So as the ball is getting reversed, we're trying to keep people occupied. We call it some backside action. If you fall asleep, you can get flared, you can get curled to the rim, you can get backscreen, you can get flared and flashed. So there's very little standing within that. So that again, as soon as we do have someone cutting to the rim, back cutting to the rim, everybody else is occupied. So you're late to try and help on that.
Great detail. Thank you. And obviously one of the other parts of it is like when a player cuts, they get into space, usually around the rim. What are you communicating with them in terms of getting out to space? Because you have that temporarily, as we said, a double gap somewhere because you're four out, one in on that cut. So talk to us a little bit about that process after the cut.
So we typically, you'll hear our staff call a lot during games, like find an X. If our spacing kind of gets out of whack or you get somebody get in and they need to get out quickly if you don't get the ball, that's something that we've emphasized heavily. Is to not just stand in crowd. So typically if you cut from, let's say, the left wing, you're typically filling back out to that left corner, unless there's been some just kind of wonky action and someone's already filled that, but you're always filling the open corner and it's typically back to the corner that you came from or that side that you came from. It's not always exact like that, but that's typically how the cadence works. So they know that's where they're filling back out to.
So if they get into bad space, because obviously in the ideal, they get into good space, but if they're finding the next and they get into bad space, what are the fix-it situations that you emphasize for them to be able to figure it out?
It's find an X. We have five X's on the floor and it's those corners, wings, and top. And if you're not in one of those, you need to find an open one.
So is that player that goes to the wrong space, they have to find the next space, or are they communicating to another player to go? Is there a different
Depending on what that looks like. If there's maybe, let's say you start to fill out and there's somebody already in that corner, they can scoot everybody over. Sometimes you'll get an unbalanced floor, but that's not always the worst thing because then you can swing and ball screen and have an open side as well. So we've typically been able to figure it out. Our bad spacing typically comes from, let's say you're swinging it wing to top and they're starting to get some of that backside action where the corner now of the person who just swung the ball is going to flare or going to backscreen or flare and flash and the ball gets swung and they go ball screen. And sometimes as you're cutting in, that ball screen action is happening, you don't recognize it quick enough. Typically, if there's a ball screen happening, we say stay wide and get a side exchange. But that's where a lot of our bad spacing will typically come from. Is if you start to cut and you don't react quick enough to a ball screen happening, then sometimes you eat into the space of a roller or a penetrator.
I love this. Thank you. Because so many coaches run five out. But I think the subtleties and the nuances are the parts that we can all improve at. And most of that has to do with spacing and respacing. And I love that you just said that to turn a bad spacing into an advantage, which obviously can flow into a ball screen. And that's such a great way to fix it in terms of that. Anything else stand out from you in terms of 5-0? Yeah.
I was going to say, I would say that we're figuring it out as we go because we are doing it differently. We created this summer based on things we liked other teams did, things we liked that we did. And so we figured it out as we went this year too, where people started to switch some things and we were like, okay, how do we take advantage better? Whether it's they switch a screen away or they switch a ball screen and us being able to take advantage of that better than I think we did early in the year. So we're always tweaking and, like you say, finding new nuances to it. And we watch a lot of other teams to try and figure out how they take advantage as well.
Talk to me about statting all 5-on-5 in practice. I love this.
Yes. So we knew our team was really deep this year and we always want it to be that because we want to play fast and we want to be able to demand a lot on the defensive end. So you have to have that depth to play at that level. We didn't play anybody over 30 minutes a game this year. So that kind of helped us. I wanted to always be sure that I had, whether it's the right combinations, the right lineups, the right people. And we emphasized being efficient and talked a lot with our team this summer about points per possession. And for, I don't know if you want me to go into more detail about the points per possession, but
love it. Love it if you would. Yeah.
Yeah. Most elite teams in college basketball are around a 1 point per possession. So that means if you're shooting from 2 point range, that means that you are shooting 50% or above. Because you're getting, let's say you're making every other layup, and that means you're scoring 2 points every two possessions, which obviously turns out to 1 point every possession. From 3 point range, it's 33%, because if you make a three every three possessions, then that's 3 points in three possessions, which gets you to one. And then we stress the high assist to turnover ratio. So that's a positive assist to turnover. We chart that every single day in practice when we're in 5-on-5. We stopped doing it in 3-on-3, 2-on-2 situations because we just felt like it wasn't as translatable to a game. But we chart that every practice. We chart that in every game. Obviously, you have to siphon out just the twos because your normal stat sheet has a field goal percentage and not a 2-point field goal percentage. So we siphon that out every single game. And so I think that's helped us to not only coach and teach and develop of helping show players, okay, this is where I can be more efficient. This is where I'm really efficient. And we need to sniff out whether it's we'll put more post-up opportunities, more 3-point opportunities, where you can turn the ball over less. And it helps direct some of those film sessions and dialogue with whether it's me or their position coach. But I think it just really helps in holding accountable of playing time and player development through the years, not in just that single year, but we sat down with all of our student athletes at the end of the year, and this is where you ended up. This is where kind of our focus is going to be this summer. And helps them continue to get better. We're big on player development. And I think it's facts. It's not opinion based.
I love a few things. One, I love you connecting it to obviously playing time in that sense that it's okay, if you want to play more next year, here are the idea of the analytics that are going to help you play more. And now they'll drive your development. The other part I really liked about it is obviously it connects practice to games and games to practice, doesn't it? It lets you know that what you're working on is helping you in the games.
Yep. And we were able to use that. I'll give you an example. When we were kind of revamping some of this summer, we were charting and we talk a lot about forcing teams when we're on defense into tough twos and us not taking tough twos, whether that's a tough crowded mid-range. And I'm not anti mid-range, but you have to be really efficient in those ones that you take. And we have a kid in our team, Amina Salimovic, who's really efficient in the mid-range and she makes over 50%. So it is a great shot for her. But other than Amina, at one point in the summer, we were like 1 of 21 from tough twos. And so we were able to show that and chart that and teach, okay, shot selection and why that's a good shot for you, why that's not a great shot, because you're 1 of 15 this summer on this shot. And then you look at somebody like Amina, who she's got a great little turnaround jumper in the post, 8 to 10 foot jumper. She's got a great 15 foot jumper. She's making a really high rate of those. And that's why that's a really highly efficient shot for her.
Just a random thought, you may not have an answer to this, but I'm curious if your players knowing that the propensity for this player to shoot a mid-range versus these other players to never shoot a mid-range, does that change their outlook on offensive rebounding and their positioning for offensive boards based on whether someone's likely to shoot mid-range or threes? Just a curious thought.
Explain more. I want to make sure I'm answering. So
what properly. I'm thinking about is a player who you're again, supporting 50% two-point shooter, more likely to shoot some twos. Players know that, so are they more likely to position themselves differently for offensive rebounds, knowing that, depending on your system, versus someone that's more likely to shoot a three, they're more likely to hang out and try and rebound in space because they tend to be longer misses. Again, just a thought.
Maybe not in that context. We have pretty hard lines of who's crashing, who's, we call our transition defense hound and safety. I don't think we've necessarily changed the positioning, and that's not a bad thing to look into. We have our constant crashers and our hound and safety. But what I would say is that something we want to put an emphasis on more this offseason is getting like dagger threes, like offensive board kickout threes. That's kind of something that I think we can take a jump in this offseason.
Hound and safety. Love it. Mm-hmm. What are some of the characteristics of the hound?
You look at Janelle Brown and Katie Lamoureux. They are pretty epitomizing, if that's a word, of our hounds. Their job is they get to a nail on an offensive shot and then they pick up whichever way the ball goes, make or miss. So on an outlet, you're getting to the closest outlet. On a make, you're picking up the ball handler. I think that's, to be honest, if I could convince anybody of that, I would try and tell anybody, because I think transition defense is one of the hardest parts of the game. And that, you know, for us, the hound takes out the ambiguity of who's stopping the ball. And I think that allows everything else to fall in place. And then when you do have mistakes, it's harder to make a kick ahead pass or a perfect rim run pass when you do have somebody like Nelly and Lammy who are great on ball defenders and disruptive from being able to make an easy, great play. That's our hound's job, is to get up, pressure the ball, work on, be the ball stopper, regardless of who it is. It doesn't matter matchup. It doesn't matter if that's not your kid or your design matchup. You're taking whoever has the ball, and then everybody else figures it out from there.
I had no doubt you're going to give us tremendous value, but between Gus and Hound now, that's just great phrasing. It's awesome. And I will say, like, I did a blog, I think probably about 4 or 5 years ago, from an NBA study from an assistant coach that shared with me on the value of nail offensive rebounding. And I love that you've connected that, because I think that, again, the simplicity of that, especially if you're thinking about coaching younger players, about designating that hound to get to that nail, it's not just about ball stopping. It's also about offensive rebounding potential, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically, we don't necessarily say there's four crashing, but you basically have a fourth crasher with
as a long rebounder, right?
Yeah, it's 3.5. And actually, I would say our guards are pretty good rebounders. So they've gotten some long and loose ones because of it each game.
You mentioned the profile of recruiting skilled roadrunners. And obviously, sometimes the sacrifice for that is you're not going to be as big in terms of pure size or height as some other teams. So talk to us a little bit about how you've adapted, because obviously a tremendous success this year, adapting to be able to account for a little bit less size, but more skill on offense.
From the defensive end, one of the things that we talked a lot about as a staff this summer was, how can we become more versatile? What was going to be our ball screen coverage? And then as we're looking at our roster, we're like, man, she could play the 3 or the 5, or she could play the 1 or the 4. We've got that ability to be versatile. And we're like, okay, how do we simplify that in terms of ball screen coverage? And if she's at the Iza, if you look at Iza on our team, she's a 6 foot, 5'11", 6 foot guard. And so how do we make that simple? And so we ended up on the concept of switching. And I coached at Minnesota when Maryland in the Big Ten was really good at switching. So I talked to Brenda and Caitlin there and picked their brains, watched a bunch of their film again to make sure that it was the right thing for us. And at the end of the day, we can be aggressive with it. We've got some really aggressive, natty guards as far as their ability to bother you. And you look at somebody like a Caitlin Benson, and when Maryland had her and she just got around, got in front, and they forced lobs, and people really struggled to exploit them for that. And it took out the ambiguity. Our ball screen coverage really is pretty simplified, so that if we're not making mistakes based on, oh, what were we in? What were we supposed to be in? You were the 3, you were the 4. You might get beat a couple times a game on a lob that you can't get to or you're late to, but you're still going to, on most other systems, you're going to have a couple miscommunications a game, not stopping the ball. I thought you were back in front. I didn't get to the ice. So it comes out in the wash. And with that, we have Nelly on our team, as I mentioned before, who's unbelievable at getting through and around ball screens. So she had her own set of rules of, if she doesn't get through, you switch. And if she gets through, great, we're still all matched up. And she's one of the best, I think, in maybe the game ever, of not getting screened in college basketball. So we have that advantage, which allowed us to negate some of those switches. So if we knew someone was trying to go at us with this guard and this post, we'd just stick her on the guard and we'd be fine. But then we had backside options of doubling the post and doubling the ball handler to negate somebody that and still have an ability to adjust if need be.
So this really highlights conceptual defense. And to me, that's, again, a characteristic of most good teams nowadays, is that instead of adhering to just one system of, say, defense, you're adaptable. And you talked about that with that individual player difference, which is incredible. But let's go back maybe. What is the base? What are the absolutes or the musts within your defense that now give them the framework for this conceptual approach?
Yeah, we talk no middle, no paint, no rhythm threes. And then the no middle part, it keeps people out of the paint. Our rotations are typically cleanest when we have some baseline drives and baseline helps. And the no paint, it probably is even more so important than the no middle, because there would be a time here and there where we knew this person was only going right or whatever, that we would have some tweaks and adjustments, because no paint was more important than no middle. And then the no rhythm threes thing is run your shooters off the line, or we're knowing obviously where those people are, but having great rotations to take away rhythm threes. Because again, you look at our offensive efficiency, the tough twos is where we get in trouble if we take too many tough twos. Our fundamentals are to force people into tough twos. We'll live with makes at tough twos, whether it's tough contested mid-range, tough twos over, help in high hands, not putting people to the free throw line. And that's been our fundamentals. But the one thing I took, and I wouldn't say the one thing, but one of the major things I took from Coach Schaefer, and I was at Mississippi State, was the fundamentals of turning and running in closeouts rather than the big push step or the big slide. And that's something that I think has really helped as well when it comes to guarding the ball. So those are some of our fundamentals.
Can you give us a little bit deeper dive in terms of that, in terms of that technique specifically?
Yep. So I always joke because I can speak from my personal example that I was not the laterally quickest player in the gym ever. And so I always joke, like, if I was going to go race you from sideline to sideline, are you going to run or are you going to slide? You're probably going to run. So we always say, okay, if I'm going to be slower, I'm going to get beat anyway if I try and slide against anybody, let alone somebody who's already quicker than me. So as I close out to the ball, my turn and run concept is instead of trying to take a big slide step, as you start to attack, let's say with your right hand, I'm turning hip to hip and running and trying to get my nose on the ball to cut you off. Because again, I think closeout's one of the hardest parts of the game. And I won't say easy tweak, but a simple way to try and negate some blow-bys and really disadvantage positions as a defensive team. So we do fundamentals on that every day as far as our turning and running and closeouts.
Love it. I love it. And just athletically makes sense, doesn't it? And if any
coach, it would help me a lot as a player.
Yeah, exactly. And any coach that puts themselves in a situation, like you said, do a race and see which is better and which is faster and which helps you stop better and all these different things. And most of it comes back to athletic sense. And some of these things as coaches, we've just overcoached to the sense that we've made it more complicated than it is.
We definitely do that as coaches. And we all steal from each other. So when you find something you like, you steal it.
I love it. I love it. You've had so many great influences, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but maybe talk to us about what a practice looks like, because you've given us a great picture of what you're trying to do conceptually, offensively, and defensively. What does a practice look like for Fairfield?
We almost every day of the week watch film. We always start with some type of film, whether it's early in the season and it's practice film against our scout guys. Once we get to season, we have a pretty normal film cadence of focusing on ourselves, then focusing on the next opponent. So the first 20, 30 minutes is almost always film. And then depending on the day, I don't like doing the same thing day in, day out, the same routine. I like to try to keep it fresh and mix it up. But we always have an offensive and a defensive segment. And I call it that routine and just flip-flops, which comes first. But in a defensive segment, we're always going to do what we call a go for defense, which is a lot of our turn and run fundamentals. It's a full court zigzag drill, but it's working on that turn and run versus sliding and just cutting off the ball. And then we always go into some type of a closeout in the half court and then a shell drill. And the nice thing about the shell drill, this is another kind of concept I took from Coach Schaefer, is it's always fours, four on four, because if you typically can cover some rotations with four, then it gets a little bit easier when you add a fifth defender. And so there's a shell offense that we use that's our main staple. But then depending on what we want to work on that day with the fours, we can create a continuous down screen action, or we can create a continuous mid pick action or continuous wing action, depending on what we want to get lots and lots of reps of in a short amount of time. And that's helped us, whatever the concept is that where you talk about concept basketball, whatever we want to get a lot of reps of, we can get in shell. And then almost we always have some version of a transition defense segment. Offensively, we always get some version of whether it's a guard meet breakdown. It could be a 3-on-3 of our motion breakdowns of working on different reads. We have a great group of scout guys that we get to go against that help a ton, where they can just play defense and we're only focusing on the offensive end at this point. And then whatever our offensive segment, we get to 5-on-5 at some point in practice, whether it's right then and there, we go an OD segment, an ODO. It could be a roll the ball where you're getting an advantage or a disadvantage running in transition. And so then we play from there based on whatever else we need.
I want to come back, and thanks for sharing that. I want to come back to shell drill, because I've had a lot of conversations with coaches about that. And it strikes me from what you're saying is, yeah, you have a structure to your shell drill, but it's very variable relative to what you need to prepare for. So within a week, getting ready for an opponent, are you tailoring your shell drill towards those specific actions then?
Yes. To give an example, we typically have like a pass and cut down screen one that just allows for communication in and out of help side, penetration. That's our go-to. But then let's say we're playing a team with dribble drive. We'll readjust those four to some dribble weave, dribble drive actions, maybe like a cut through and dive and a dribble off to, like you said, create the double gap. We'll get a ton of reps of that. And then you're still going to go through and guard their 5-on-5 at some point the day before the game or 2 days before the game. But I just think it allows for, if you jump on, let's say we typically try to get three stops in a row. The first team to get three stops in a row wins. And so you jump on, you jump off, you can guard a different position. You can guard the corner, you can guard the top. And so it allows for just consecutive reps of that action in a lot of different forms.
So I'm curious about this, because again, I've had this conversation with a few clients this summer about the value of having your guys to play against in practice. Obviously, we can think about the value, But one thing I was stimulating them on and love to hear your thoughts on is one of the negatives potentially is it's taking away reps from your players in terms of offensive and defensive situations, particularly potentially perceptual reps of learning how to run different things. And I'm curious kind of if I'm on the right track, because I'm not necessarily right, and if there's any other challenges from having guys in practice to be able to play against.
I'm a big proponent of guys in practice against for a lot of reasons. I think you can't attribute this just to this, but I think we were able to stay really healthy this year. And I think it's partially because we didn't play anybody high minutes. Our strength coach did, and trainer did a great job. But I also think we didn't have to take every rep for 6 straight months in practice. And I think that mattered as far as our being able to be fresh and not worn down. I think the way we set it up, and it's not perfect. There's not really a perfect system, but we are very much a like high pace, high reps where we're going to, you might be on 3 straight possessions and then the next group's coming on. And so we only had 12 players that were able to play this year. So it was constantly on and off that you weren't really sitting for long periods of time in practice. It allowed everybody in our gym to get a lot of reps. And so you might not get offensive reps of shell where you're playing dribble drive, but we're not a dribble drive team anyway. I don't love it when we have to go and get ready for a team. We don't have guys and we're having our team sit in a 2-3 zone and we don't play 2-3 zone. So I'd rather not spend time on things that don't matter to us anyway.
Love it. Love it. And it connects WNBA, NBA. They have coaches play and practice and different things like that. And most of it, as you said, comes back to workload management and just love that and connecting that for us. And you mentioned something about keeping your players fresh. And I saw this and I think it was your quote, but I may be paraphrasing, but recognizing that you can't pour from an empty cup. This concept of keeping your players fresh, but not just physically, but mentally as well, and the importance of self-care for them. Can you dive a little bit deeper with us for that?
Yeah. First and foremost, my background is in sports psychology. So I really do try to give them as many resources and ways to pour into their mental game as well. Particularly in our first year, I did a lot with meditation, and we are fortunate enough to have a mental health counselor for our athletes here at Fairfield. So we have that as a resource. But I think that there's such a balance and such a nuance to it that thankfully I've played at this level and can remember the days that started to feel long, and you remember how February feels and things like that. But I think finding nuance, like where there's going to be days that we're still going to go really hard and we're going to get up and down, but we don't need to go for 2+ hours. We can do the same thing we need to in an hour and a half. Reading them when sometimes they might be tired or whatever it is, and they still need to get a push. And then there's days where you can back off and know that you can find a happy medium. I think a lot of conversation with our players just in where they're at and showing them film and just meeting them where they're at and knowing when they need a push still.
Knowing your background in psychology, positive psychology seems to be practiced quite nicely, but also you couldn't be this good if you didn't challenge and push your players and get them beyond their comfort level. So talk to us about balancing that and then some of the ways that you hold your players accountable and push them beyond their current level.
I'm really fortunate to have learned from Sue Semrau as my first ever boss in this business. And she, I'll never forget, she always used to say, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I spent a lot of time. It's just a lot of time to build relationships and be genuine with our student athletes. And so I think it's easy to push them once you do have that trust built. And so part of the trust is just built on being there and them knowing how much you care about them, but also being really transparent of, hey, you did this really well. You didn't do this well. And here I can show you where we can get better. And not even just say, okay, you stunk at this today, but how can we get better at that? And not only myself, but my staff is incredible at that. So they're getting that from all angles. On the day that I can't get to all 12, 13, 14, my assistants are making sure that, oh, I already got this one for film. We already talked about it. Or I already talked to her about this and she's going through this. So it's not just on my shoulders every day to do that. But I think that relationship then allows me to get into them when they need to. And you might be familiar with Safu Bernard, but he works with the Mystics and he always talks about making deposits. So you're constantly putting deposits into your student athletes or even within each other as teammates. So then when you do need to make a withdrawal, you're not pulling from an empty account and overdrawn, constantly giving love and attention and feedback and positive feedback. So then when you do need to lay down the hammer a little bit, they know where you're coming from and you've got something to draw back on.
I love that. And that seems to be a real struggle for some coaches as they think about the modern player or the modern young person, about how that we can't push or challenge them exactly the same way as we used to. It's great to hear your thoughts on that. And going a little bit further with that, I'm curious kind of how all this connects back to your offensive philosophy, particularly around sacrifice, because it seemed to be pretty good balance this year for your team as well. Certainly, we know who the best players are, but at the same time, there was really good balance for your roster. And I imagine that would be hard to scout against. So talk to us about how you created that sacrifice.
I'll start by, I talked a lot at the beginning about just the people that I have on my roster. And you talk about who the best players are. Meg and Nelly on our team got the most attention as far as accolades and things like that. But I have ideas and concepts and standards and things like that. But if those two weren't as selfless and as they were and as humble superstars as they are, then it doesn't work. And so every accolade they got, they credited their team and they poured it right back into their teammates. So much of the credit goes to them on that. But we early in the, I can't remember if it was late summer or early fall, we did a little bit of an activity of how many minutes in your perfect world do you think you should and want to play? And I think our minutes added up to 350 or 75 minutes or something like that. We're like, okay, guys, we have a 200 minute game. So everybody, whether you feel like you should play 30 minutes or 10 minutes, is going to have to sacrifice. And some nights you might play 30 minutes and some nights you might not. And so we set that tone early, but the strength of our team is our depth, because our team knew that we had a lot of really good players on our team. And so we set that tone early of, okay, we're do what we want to do. You're not going to get everything you want. And then the fun thing is the season went on, we changed our lineups a lot. It wasn't always just this five versus that five. They played with different groups in practice every day. And then as the game started to go, somebody different stepped up every game. Sometimes it was Nelly. It would be Amina. And then it would be Katie Lamro. And it was somebody different. And so that really solidified the fact that we need everybody to win and win the way that we want to. And then we just had great selfless humans. We shout out our teammates every single day after practice to point out those little things that might not be stat oriented that we show from an efficiency standpoint, but that mattered on a successful team. So I think constantly bringing that up and showing that was intentional.
You come from a coaching family. Obviously, you've mentioned a few of the influences already, particularly focusing on you've been waiting for this opportunity your whole life in a way and preparing for it. So talk to us about maybe some of those first steps when you got the job last year, and kind of some of the things that maybe surprised you despite your incredible background and experiences, because I think that's always the case for coaches, no matter what.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know that I always knew I wanted to be a head coach, which I think surprises a lot of people. I loved being an assistant and I had a bunch of people around me. They're like, oh, you'll be a head coach someday. And I didn't know when I'd be ready, if I'd be ready. It always seemed like this big, daunting, scary task. And then I had to coach a couple games at Minnesota when my boss had appendicitis. So then I coached a couple games and I was like, oh, this isn't as bad as I get it now. I see that this is cool, where you're in charge of helping the end result. So that kind of was my turning point. But I think from my family, I've been prepared in so many ways to, as I build kind of my own identity. I've worked for different people who are all very different, which I'm very fortunate for, my family included. And so I was able to take bits and pieces to build what my identity is as a coach. I think the hardest things early on is just being, meeting, like I said earlier, meeting your team where you're at, while still building to where you want to go, and finding that happy medium, I think was one of the bigger challenges. And then I had to go from being a doer as an assistant coach and a recruiting coordinator. You've got your checklist and your to-do list and all these things. And now as the head coach, you have to make some time to just think and plan and visualize and be visionary and work your calendar and like all these things that are a little bit more big picture and you have to take time for. And I'm used to constantly doing and moving and all that. That was like, okay, when do I work? Like I'm telling you here and I'm talking to you here and I'm meeting and you're meeting and you're meeting. And you're like, okay, I need to carve out time to like actually think.
Coaches talk about it too, is particularly in this phase, obviously recruiting and transfer portal. It's really hard to carve out time to think about basketball, isn't it? And especially because I know that was one of the parts you probably loved about being an assistant, is obviously spending time immersed in the game. So talk to us a little bit about how you still carve out some time to be able to obviously improve from a tactical, technical, philosophical standpoint.
This offseason was so much fun. And I know I've credited my staff, but we had a staff retreat that I think literally changed the trajectory of what we did this year. I gave everybody a different kind of task to learn on and report on when we got to our staff retreat. Different areas of our game that we wanted to elevate. And so I gave Erica Brown to look at different teams' presses. We knew we could take a little bit of a level up. We were never going to be a press all game long type of team. And I gave her those parameters. We're not going to spend an hour in practice on this every day. You might get a 10-minute segment, but where can we have something that we can throw in after a free throw or after a dead ball or after a timeout and then stay in it if it works type of thing. So she studied a bunch of pressing teams. knowing our personnel and presented on what she felt was going to be best for our team. Blake, I gave special situations, reviewing our baseline sidelines from last year. Where can we get better? Where can we simplify, tailor it to this year's team? My Dobo, I gave a scouting report on our team as I wanted her to be more involved in scouting this year, as well as that would help us pinpoint some player development things for our players that summer. And then Eric Johnson and I worked on our offense, and he watched Creighton and Drake. And I had watched Drake a ton as I scouted them in Minnesota and watched Florida Gulf Coast and reported on what made them successful. And then I reported on transfer rate in our league as well, and who translated, if there was trends of who translated. And we all put that all together, and we're able to then, after doing all those reports on the first day, sit down and be like, okay, now how do we implement this? What does this look like for our team? What do we like? What do we not like? And I think that was really a turning point before our whole team came back in June to start to implement it.
I'm not saying that's an outlier necessarily, but my instinct is that a lot of those retreats happen more towards August, and doing it at that time of year. Talk to us about that, because obviously that leads into your spring, summer, as you said.
No, we heavily relied on and needed June and July and the beginning of August for this team, because we had 7 new players coming in to a team of 8 already. So it was almost half and half, and we had a great opportunity to set that tone early and start to build not even just our, we weren't having a ton of full team practices early on, but what skills are going to be needed and necessary. And you ask questions about the basics. What's the basic level of skill that we need to start teaching? And if we're going to guss, you have to be able to guss and make fast layups, but you have to be able to jump stop if you get cut off. And so being able to start implementing those skills in individual workouts was essential.
Love it. Love it. And for you, going into year 3 with all the success and now some expectations, obviously, what is one of the most important things for you to be able to manage about yourself as a coach to be successful this season?
I think for me, it's still being able to not lose sight of the standards that we started with. That's ultimately what drove a lot of our success. We had great players and great, my staff is great. And so much of our success and our consistent success was because everyone was bought into doing things the right way every single day. And so while it's easy to take 3 steps forward, you don't want to lose sight of what kind of built that. And I think that's going to be a personal challenge for me to make sure I start and end my day with the values versus the wins and the results. And then for our team, we've already talked about it a lot, is just not being complacent. We're not where we want to be yet. And we were 33 points away from winning an NCAA tournament game. So we still have a big, you know, margin to make up. We do that skill development, bringing in great players to continue to add, but we still have a long way to go to achieve our goals. So not being complacent.
Carly, this has been amazing. I really appreciate you sharing so much. And obviously so much of it that went into the tremendous success of your program. And just great things ahead, really exciting. And I encourage coaches to go watch your team if they haven't and dive deep on Synergy. But thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. And if anybody has any suggestions as you listen, oh, this could help them, I'm all ears. Like I said, we're all just in the business of stealing things from each other and fine-tuning it to what works for us. So I appreciate you having me, and go Stags.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and to give the Basketball Podcast and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support for us sharing the game. And to stay up to date on all things Basketball Immersion, subscribe to our newsletter at basketballimmersion.com/newsletter.